Welcome everyone to the group chat brought to you by Overmark. I'm your host Daryl, and today with me is one of our star tutors, the tutor that has been here with Overmark for a really long time, and I'm super excited to bring her on the podcast this time. None other than Miss Pamela Low. You want to introduce yourself, Pam?
Hi, I'm Miss Pamela. So I've been teaching or tutoring for the past sort of like 13 years, I think. So then it has been a very long journey for me, and I would supposedly call it as my calling, because I think all the tutors and all teachers across Singapore would know that teaching, it has to be a calling. It can't be a job kind of thing. So what we have to deal with in class is really different. So I've been enjoying my teaching process so far, and I hope to do it for a very long time. And at Overmark, currently, I purely do physics, which is something that I enjoy. And it's kind of interesting for me because the more I learn about physics, the more I realize there are more things that I don't know, and there are more things that I want to discover as well. So I'm happy to be on this journey and happy to be on this podcast today.
Yes, Pam's our subject head here at Overmark for Physics. So I also learned a lot from Pam because I also teach physics. But today, we'll be diving in more into A-level H2 physics, right? So last minute tips to get your A for your H2 physics at A-levels. So maybe Pam, we can set a bit of the context here. Let's say if I'm a JC student currently looking to score an A for H2 physics, you know, what should I be focusing on? So what's the components of the paper, and in terms of scoring, you know, what should be the target mark for each paper, etc.?
Okay, so knowing that you want to get A for physics, right? And obviously the good news is you don't have to study hard. That's what I believe. For physics, you don't have to study hard. You just have to study smart, especially now that it's so near the exam, you need to have a game plan. So hopefully for today's podcast, we're able to, you know, create a game plan for you guys or the students so that they know how to start or how to even begin their revision. And the first thing that I feel to be able to get do well for an exam is know your enemies. You know, I think there's this Chinese phrase, something something bai zhan bai shen, something like, you know your enemies well, you more qing tam men de di, then you'll be able to do the paper. Correct? So for H2 physics, for those who are taking H2 physics, I believe you guys will be able to know that there are four papers. Paper one is usually about MCQ, multiple choice. But the thing about paper one that you need to be able to do well is you need to train your speed and your precision, because MCQ is all about finding the fastest way to find the answers to that particular question, and then be able to do the paper as fast as you can so they have enough time to review your answers as well. Then paper two, we have short structured questions. So those are like your written questions whereby they usually test you on fundamentals and definitions. So you need to be able to know your concepts really, really well. Then we move on to paper three, where we have sort of like essay questions or longer structured questions. Usually that paper, right, they do application based. They go in depth into integration of different topics, and integration of topics that you will never even think of, like, oh, what do you mean by I can mix electricity with kinematics, something like that. Okay. And then lastly, our paper four is our good old practical paper that a lot of students are very afraid of, because this is the paper where you cannot prepare yourself fully for it. Because number one, you will know what topic will come out. Number two, you will know how are they going to test us in terms of skills wise. Okay. But we do have certain ways of preparing for the paper as well. So in order for you to be able to do well for your paper, you need to be able to master the four papers.
Yeah, definitely. I think knowing the components of what goes into your paper is the first step, because otherwise, how do you know, what should you be expecting and how to do well for each. But of course, components of the paper is one part. Let's really dive into the specifics for H2 physics. So I would say, Pam, there are many topics in H2 physics, right? So which are the ones typically that you think students struggle with? Can we maybe go a bit deeper into each of this and clarifying what exactly is it that they need to know in order to score well?
Okay, so for let's talk about the J1 topics first. What a lot of students tend to struggle with, right? The very first topic would be things like circular motion, because this is something that they have not seen in their secondary school physics before. And it's something new whereby the students have to learn now about motions in circles. So things like roller coaster right along a circular track, or things like a ball just spinning in circle. So circular motion is something that students tend to struggle with. Then the next topic, simple harmonic motion, where they bring in oscillation. And when they combine these two topics together, right, that's where students tend to be very confused about. So They need to be able to understand that when you learn topics like circular motion and simple harmonic motion, the conditions are very important. Like what constitute a circular motion and what constitute a simple harmonic motion. So from all my years of teaching, I always tell my students, you need to understand that circular motion is usually like being on a Singapore Flyer. You know, when you're on a Singapore Flyer, you're in one of the carriages and you're moving around the flyer, there is a force that is trying to pull you inward. So why are there so many spokes that are actually putting the carriages in a circular design is so that your carriage don't fall back into the center of the Singapore Flyer. So circular motion is something like that. But simple harmonic motion is like imagine a child sitting on a swing and then the child is going back and forth like a pendulum. There will always be a force that pulls the child back to the center. So that's the difference between these two. Circular motion is there is a force pulling you inwards, but simple harmonic motion is a force pulling you back towards the center. So that's one thing that students tend to struggle with, the difference, then which lead them to not be able to identify the question correctly and hence use the appropriate formulas. So I hope being able to understand the conditions like this will be able to help them differentiate what is circular motion and what is simple harmonic motion. Then after that, moving on to the second most dreaded topic that a lot of students tend to not do well in, which is called superposition. So I think superposition is a very abstract topic because it's something that is very niched. How niche is it? It is one of the application for superposition is where they actually go to see a 3D movie. You know, when you guys going to see a 3D movie and they make you wear a 3D specs and then you start seeing all the images pop up. So if you ask yourself, why does this happen? The basic principle is actually superposition. So superposition, this topic, right, is about waves adding up together, waves canceling out each other. So you need to have the presence of two waves. So how I usually explain this topic to students and make them better understand the concept is, imagine you guys go karaoke. You know, a lot of students like to go karaoke and sing. Or maybe our generation lah, you know, the Gen Z, maybe not so much. So when your friends and you guys are singing in sync, you know, in sync, we call that constructive interference in superposition, then the song will turn out to be very loud, very powerful. So in superposition, this is what it means. When two waves meet in phase, then you will have constructive interference and you will have a very loud and powerful wave. However, if there is one of your friend that starts to sing out of tune, off beat, so then we call that destructive interference. Then you realize the song will become very awkwardly soft, sometimes even awkwardly silent. Maybe both of you stop singing, like, hey, what's going on? Why is there like out of tune singer? So in superposition, this is what we call destructive interference as well, whereby the waves cancel out each other, resulting in a very soft wave or no wave, sometimes no wave at all. So this analogy will be able to help you guys, students, to understand the importance of what we call path difference and phase difference. So a lot of students tend to mix up path difference and phase difference because path difference is really about how far the wave has traveled and how far the two waves have traveled, comparing the distance that they travel to find out at the end of the day, do I get a loud wave or do I get a soft wave? Whereas phase difference is to find out the difference between the two waves traveling, meaning to say that if I have one wave that travels faster or slower, then how fast is that wave compared to the other wave? So that's what we call phase difference. So that's for the J1 topics. Now for J2 topics, what a lot of students tend to struggle with, which I feel is something that the Sec 4s also do struggle with, is a topic on electromagnetism. So I believe, Daryl, you taught EM and EMI. A lot of students tend to struggle with Faraday, lenses. They start to ask themselves, why are they even studying this law? Like, how is that important? So the thing I feel it for students is because these two laws are very abstract. They can't see it. They obviously can't relate to the two guys since they are already like dead and whatnot. So they tend to not be able to understand. I mean, they get the topic, they get the definition, they get the law, but then when we get them to explain, right, they usually tend to struggle. So how I like to let students know is that imagine they are they take MRT. Let's say they take the MRT in Singapore. And then before they board the MRT, they need to tap their card, correct? So why is it that whenever they tap their card, there will be a beep sound? You know, some students will say, oh, because of NFC, some cards scanner and things like that. So how I like to relate to them is like, I'll say, okay, imagine that gantry scanner is your magnetic field. And then your card is your conductor. So the moment you swipe, you're cutting the magnetic field lines. And then when you cut, current starts to be generated. So that's the induced current that causes the beeping sound to be created. So then when I say things like that, they will be able to understand. Then when I say if you cut it faster, then you realize the gantry opens faster. So if you change the rate of cutting, then what happens is you'll be able to pass through the gantry faster. So hopefully with this kind of analogy, you'll be able to understand what Faraday's laws is as well. So I have one student who also tend to struggle with explaining. Like for example, they will say, I want to explain why is there a current generated? Explain why is there a pulse in motion? They tend to like to use laws to explain. They will say like, oh, because Faraday said so, because Lenz said so. I don't know who they are, but because they said this, that's why I'm just going to write it in the answer. So I think it's very important for them to understand that whenever they write down answers, they cannot use laws to explain. And that's where understanding the law is very important because they need to be able to decipher the law and pick out key words from the law to explain the answers. And the very last topic that I think a lot of J2 students tend to struggle with, even I myself struggle with as well because it's a very abstract topic, is called quantum and nuclear physics. The thing about JC physics, right, what makes it very interesting is this very last topic, quantum and nuclear. And for those students who love the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right, they will love this topic a lot because quantum physics and nuclear physics helps them to understand why, you know, when Tony Stark say if they want to reverse that 5 years disappearance of most of the Earth's population, they need to undergo a time loop and things like that. So everything can be explained if they were to understand quantum physics and how Ant-Man became so small and then so big and then so small again without like losing his head and limbs is purely because of quantum physics as well. The good thing is, what I like to tell my students to get them motivated about this topic is you have to approach this topic with a mindset that whatever you are learning is simply just the foundational theory. Because as of now, quantum and nuclear physics are still not that advanced in the sense that it's very complicated. Because we're dealing with things that are theoretical. It is not, in a sense, happening in reality. And if they were to actually happen in reality, it takes a lot of technological advances as well as money as well. So what students learn is really just on the surface. And then I'll usually advise them to read up more because all about space, outer space. So what students like to do is they tend to get very confused in this topic whereby, let me ask you a question like that. For example, right, is light a wave or a particle? Like,
According to
do you
my
think?
O-level physics knowledge, it's a wave.
Yeah, so in Sec 4, what they learn is light is a wave. But in junior college, they will suddenly learn that light is also a particle. So then a lot of students will be like, huh, what do you mean by it's a wave and it's a particle? Because clearly, wave and particles are two different things. Wave is continuous, there is no breakage. Particles is like one little bit thrown at you, two little bit thrown at you, things like that. So to do well in this topic, right, my advice to students is since it's very foundational, purely know the definitions very clearly, know the experiments very clearly because that's what Cambridge like to test. They test the definitions, they test what are my experiments, what are my findings, especially, and tell me what does the experimental result shows. So that's what they like to test for this topic. Then since the Cambridge can't really test that much on this topic, right? They like to twist the basic stuff lah. So they make it complicated in the sense that, oh, now I'm going to give you another scenario that uses the same basic concept. But maybe tell me how you're going to apply this concept into such a topic as well. So for these two topics, right, simply just know the basics, know the experiments very well, then students usually be able to do well.
Yeah, for me, I think the big jump was this. I mean, I did well for my O level physics, right? Like I got A1 and stuff. But when I jumped over to A level physics, right, for me the difficulty were the new topics that weren't present, right? I think one big one for me that I really struggled to wrap my head around in J1 was the whole concept of centripetal force and circular motion, right? It was so abstract. And I think quantum was also not easy. But at the end of the day, I would say when it comes to physics must be something that you understand. Physics is not something you can just purely memorize and try to regurgitate. Because more and more we see in the exams is about the ability to apply these concepts and solve questions. So if you're a physics student and you're wondering, how do I get an A? I think always across the board for any scientific concept is about learning to understand and then applying. So don't go down the route of trying to memorize your way through physics. Truth is, you will not go
Yes.
far lah. Right?
Correct. I have a student who recently just asked me, a J1 student, like how to do well for physics because she has been struggling to do well. And then so I throw her the question, I say, how about you tell me how you revise for physics? And she said, "Oh, I just read through my concepts, and then I try a little bit of questions, and then I go to the exam hall. And then I realized, yeah, I don't know anything at all. I don't even know how to start a question. So then usually what I tell my students is that physics cannot be practiced the way how you do other sciences like chemistry or bio, because in JC, physics is really about math. And I think those who are taking H2 physics can feel that it is tailored more towards math rather than a scientific concept. Because a lot of my students are telling me, hey, this concept I learned before when I was in primary school even. I'm like, yeah, because the physical concepts don't change. The laws will never change. The theory won't change. So how they test you is basically just making it more abstract by throwing in a lot of mathematical stuff. So then I ask my student, how do you usually do well for math? And then she'll be like, oh, I start doing a lot of practice questions. I practice papers every day. So I say, you don't simply just memorize the formula, then go for the exam, right? Then the same way for physics also. How I advise my students is know the concept, that's the first thing. And then every day start doing 5 questions a day. I mean, there's 365 days a year. You minus, let's say, 60 days for holidays and whatnot. You still have about 300 days left. 300 days times 5 questions, that's about 1,500 questions that you can do for physics. So if you can do 1,000 over questions, I'm pretty sure you will actually improve your physics results as well. So my way of approaching a physics exam paper is usually do it like how you do a math paper. Do a lot of practice, drill on the foundations rather than just memorizing and go for an exam.
Totally. Anyway, we'll go for a quick advertisement break and we'll be right back. I hope you have been enjoying the contents of the podcast so far. If you want to find out more about the latest study tips and exam strategies, do check out my free ebook that you can download on our website. Additionally, if you are curious about how OMAC classes are like, feel free to join us for a free trial lesson anytime. Back to the podcast. All right, we're back now. Back to the second half. So I think earlier part we started with really breaking down how the paper is structured and for specific topics how you should be approaching them. I want to move more into actionables now, right? Pep, so when we're thinking of how do we revise for H2 physics, let's set it in the context of now is a few months away from our A levels or for our promos itself. How should we approach it? Do we go like more topically? Do we do TYS or do we start grinding through prelim papers? What will you encourage students? How do they start?
So for students whose basics are very weak, I would recommend them to actually go topical first, because if they don't get their concepts right, there's no point going to prelim paper because they will still be stuck anyway. But what I usually advise students to do, right, is that whenever they do topical, I will recommend them to actually read through the concepts first. Then as they go into topical questions, because a lot of schools do issue them a lot of topical questions as revision, I will get them to actually put their concept maps or their concepts by the side, and then do the topical questions while referring to their notes, so that while they are doing the question, they are also revising their concepts as well. So they don't waste time memorizing, because the more they are exposed to this concept visually, naturally it will come to them. Concepts will be ingrained in them. They don't have to use the extra effort to go and memorize it. Okay, so it's like all these little conceptual doubts or conceptual misunderstandings are like little leaks inside the ship. They need to first mend these leaks first before they can start their journey. Then once they are done with their basics, their foundations are strong enough, instead of going straight into prelim papers, because prelim papers are known to be way harder than the general A level questions, and it's more tailored towards students who want to challenge themselves with difficult questions, I would recommend students to go into TYS first. Because once the basic is stronger, move to TYS questions and try those TYS questions. Not only do the students actually get a whole of how the topics can be integrated, but the TYS, right, is basically like a map of all the common routes that Cambridge would take, like what topics do Cambridge actually merge together? Doing the TYS, right, students can see, oh, so this is how Cambridge works in a sense. This is how they think. They want this topic to this topic together, and then this is the type of questions that they can come up with. And the TYS questions are a notch easier as compared to the prelims question. So while doing them, right, it helps build students' confidence as well. So after settling their topical, they can move on to TYS. Now, once they are done with the TYS, or rather, while doing the TYS, and let's say they are stuck, right? I wouldn't recommend students to actually get stuck on that question for so long. Rather, if they look at a question and they don't know how to do that question, I would recommend them to go to the solutions and look at the solutions and pick out what is the concept that they are testing on. And then if students realize, hey, this concept, right, I really cannot understand, then go back to the concept in their notes and relearn it again. So rather than reading the entire chapter and finding that, wow, it's so overwhelming, there's so many concepts to learn, pinpoint the exact concepts from the PYS question that they did to relearn the concept that they have doubts with or they have misinterpreted with. And finally, once they're done with that, they can start doing the prelim papers, because prelim papers, right, to me are like little obstacle courses, to prepare for the big marathon. So these prelim papers, right, they are usually tougher as compared to the A levels, and then just get students to keep grinding the papers. But obviously, don't grind them mindlessly. What a lot of students tend to do is once they do the paper, right, they're like, oh, I'm done. All right. Then they mark it, then they do corrections, and then they keep it. And then they will never see the prelim paper again. So I think that's one of the common mistakes that a lot of students tend to do. They don't review their corrections. So what I did when I was a student was, right, after every prelim paper, I marked it and then I corrected it. I like to get a piece of paper and I write down all the mistakes that I have done in that prelim paper into a piece of paper. And then I'll say, okay, this is the mistake that I did. Remember, this is the concept that is needed for this question. Then I write them down. Then across 10 prelim papers, right, I can see a common trend. I will always not do well in superposition. And then this particular topic, like diffraction, or I will always not do well in another topic of electromagnetism. For example, I can never explain Lenz's law properly. So by looking at all my mistakes and analyzing them, right, I'm able to find my weakness. Then from there, I improve my weakness and make sure my strengths are well put in. So that's what I usually do or advise students to prepare themselves for the end paper.
Yeah, I would say, especially for those who are trying to grind through prelim papers, I always make it a point to remind students to do it, I would say, in a time setting. I find that to be so important because it's one thing about knowing how to do the questions, but it's another thing on doing it within the time constraint that's provided. So if you have the opportunity to, I definitely prefer if students can put themselves in, I would say, a controlled environment, very similar like in your exam, and actually sit through the whole paper. I always go back to this thing called like your concentration capacity or your stamina. So are you able to sit down and fully concentrate for 2 hours, right? I know at JC level, math paper is up to 3 hours. Do you have the mental bandwidth to stay concentrated for such a long period of time? And that's something that you need to develop and build over time. So if you're doing practice papers, like the full paper kind, I think you should actually do it in a time setting. Topical may be a bit more chill, right? Because it depends on how your topical TOS is structured. But at the end of the day, try to simulate a similar exam condition so that you can perform well in the exam. I think especially sound advice closer to the exam season right now. Pam, then I think another thing when it comes to learning, right? I think we can both agree as educators, it's very important to do corrections, right? Because correction is how we learn. But if we were to make it more precise, how should we approach doing corrections? Like, what are certain things to look out for? Like, is it a careless mistake, a content error, and how do we rectify ourselves from that point on?
I think for students, right, I mean, I don't know for you, but for my students, I find that they do corrections the wrong way. I mean, I give the solution, I explain to them, they simply just write down the corrections, and like I said, they will never see the question ever again, and they won't learn anything out from me. So how I feel they should approach corrections or wrong questions that they have done would be, first of all, they have to first identify what kind of correction is it. Was it a careless mistake? Simply a careless mistake? Was it a content error, meaning they really don't know their content well and they use the wrong content? Or was it a misinterpretation of the question? So did they read the question wrongly? Did they not know, or did they don't know what the question wants from them? So once they have categorized their mistake, the next thing they have to do is, if they were to identify that it's a careless mistake, how to fix it is usually I advise students to fix it with habit, meaning to say, underline all the keywords, make sure that they read the question thoroughly. So underlining is a very important skill that I make my students do, and I do myself when I'm analyzing the question with them. Circling key phrases, circling command words, all these allows them to be able to put their focus into what is actually tested in the question. So if it's a careless mistake, I'll get them to fix it with habit, so underlining keywords. If it's a content error, so that means the mistake was made because it was due to them not knowing the correct content or using the wrong content, then I'll get students to relearn that particular content. And that's where students should write down, okay, this question is testing me on this content, but instead I use this content. All right? So why did I use this content? Was there something that misled me, or was it something that I'm not aligning with the question itself? So usually what I would like to get students to do is relearn the concepts first from their textbooks or from their notes, cover it, and then start rewriting the concepts in their own words on a piece of paper. Then double check with their concepts and see the actual concepts in the notes and see is there something that they are missing. And then the third mistake is if they were to categorize that mistake as a misinterpretation, then I would advise students to read slowly. I think across all the years of education, a lot of teachers will always tell their students, read the question, read the question. But then being students, right, I myself also made the mistakes. So whenever I see big diagrams or when I see tables and graphs, the first thing I read is the table and graph. Then I'll start answering the question. I will never go and read all the preamble. So I would advise students to actually read the preambles carefully, read them slowly, and then start understanding what the question is. So what I usually tell my students in class is read slowly but write faster so that you can be able to finish the paper in time as well. Then once they are done with that, then when they write down their solutions, they'll be able to fully understand, okay, why I made this mistake, this is hence the correct solution. Then don't stop there. If they can, bring it up another level by doing another similar question, like a clone question, find another question with the same concept tested. And then usually that's where I come in. That's where I, as a tutor, I will tell my students, okay, here is another similar question that most of you guys usually tend to do wrong in. Let's start doing this question to reinforce their corrections so that they can learn. Okay, so now every time I see this type of question, I'm going to just use this approach.
I also advise students, right, especially closer to this point exam, right, I like to have this thing called like a correction bin or correction folder or like a photo of it. So what I do, right, is I tell my students, hey, if you made a mistake here and you think, this is shaky, that means I'm not fully confident if I have learned from this mistake. I'll note it down. Like you can take a screenshot, take a photo, put it somewhere in a folder, and maybe a few days before or the weekend before your paper, you want to go revisit every question in the bin again. Right, what is improvement? Improvement is just defined as not making the same mistakes as you did before. So what you want to course correct is to make sure that every mistake that you made, whether it's careless, whether it's a conceptual error, you have actually learned from it and you make sure that you don't make the same mistake again. And the most effective way to ensure that is to review everything once again. So if you review and you resolve the question and you can solve it, it clearly showed progress and learning. And actually, improvement comes a lot easier than you think. It's just really about making sure you don't keep making the same mistakes again, right? Because if you keep making the same mistakes again, you're essentially stuck at that same point, lah, right? You're not actually moving forward. So what we're trying to emphasize on is when we say learning, learning is just AKA, improving from your current state by not making the same mistakes again. So we cannot emphasize enough on the importance of corrections, but not just doing corrections, but doing it in a way whereby you go back to review, you actually deeply learn from your mistake, not just copying down correction. Right? A lot of students, you are obsessed with like, oh God, correction, just write. But are you internalizing, right, what the mistake here is? So corrections to a certain extent, I always emphasize, especially in science, you can do it in point form. There's no need to write down the full sentence. The English is not that important, right? But the main concept, the main keywords you have to capture. Yeah. Hey, maybe if we were to round up this entire podcast, right, with a shout out to A-level students that are struggling with physics, what is like one thing you would like to tell them?
So this year I'm very big on mental health because I have come across students who tend to struggle with their mental health with respect to studies as well. And I can see how it does affect the grades as well. So for students who are currently struggling, I would want them to actually take a break. It's okay to take a break. It's okay to tell themselves, say, it's okay. I'm not good at this topic right now, or I'm not good at this subject right now. You embrace the fact that you are not good at it first. So accepting that this is your weakness and then start slow. So a lot of students tend to be very obsessed with they need to reach 100% revision by the time they go to the A levels or by the time they go to the end of the exam. To me, right, I feel that if 100% is too far-fetched, 25% is good enough, 50% is good enough, 75% is good enough, as long as they are able to pace themselves well. And I would rather them get a very good solid 25% revision than a half-hearted 100% revision. And then feel by the time when they reach the A level, it's like, what did I just study? I totally didn't know. I'd rather they are very good at 25%. And slowly, slowly, once they build their confidence level up, then they start pick up their pace of revision. I hope that students who are struggling right now, number one, first, obviously embrace the fact that it is a tough topic. It is not a very easy journey. Then number two, start slow, start small. Maybe start with topics that interest them the most. So how I keep myself motivated with studying was I started with the topics that I like. So I push the topics that I don't like to the very, very, very last to study so that I can, just like, okay, let's just quickly get it over and done with. Okay, but then the topics that I like, I go over them first, and then it keeps me motivated because it makes me want to learn more, want to do well in that topic. And then once my confidence level is built up, then I let myself just go with the flow of the process. It naturally just make me want to revise more and more and get better and better at the topic. So.
Yeah, definitely. I think mental health is sometimes either underused or overused. I don't know what's the correct way to frame it, but it is important. If you're a student and right now you are feeling burnt out and you are not able to move forward, it is perfectly fine to take a break, right? Taking break is in fact good. So generally, I think students nowadays, right, we either go too chill or we chong too much. So I was just telling my class like literally yesterday, right, what's the ideal number of hours you should be spent studying? Then I told them, I'm just going to give you a benchmark. For some of you, this is enough. For some of you, this is too little. But it kind of depends on which part of your journey you're on. Let's say you have been a consistent one, right? You've been attending tuition, you're listening in school, you did your homework. Then there's no need to sprint and burn yourself out. But let's say if you know your eventual goal is I want to score that A1 or that A, but you haven't been putting in the work, then all the more you need to acknowledge you have to work extra hard while making sure that you're pacing yourself. Ultimately, the race towards A level is more like a marathon than a sprint. If you sprint too early, you're gonna get too burnt out to even cross the finish line. So it's about maintaining that pace and slowly building upon it. So at the end of the day, if you're not in the mental state, right, you even if you try to learn, it won't be effective. So remember to take breaks, remember to take care of yourself, both physically and mentally. If you are like an athlete like I was when I was a student, don't completely stop exercising. Go for your runs, play a bit of sports. Really try to bring in that good vibes and the good hormones in your body so that you're still in a state to focus, to put in effort into your studies. So if you're an A-level student, I know it's stressful. We've been through the process. It's not easy, but just trust yourself that you'll be able to pull through like always. And I think with that, we come to the end of today's podcast. Pam, thank you so much for coming on. For the
No
listeners who enjoyed
problem.
this podcast, continue to follow through because we'll be inviting even more tutors to share on topics that you guys are interested on. So follow us on Spotify, YouTube, wherever you're on, because we'll be uploading more and more content going to the exam season. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.